This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. He's written a new book about the brain that explains some of the latest research, debunks myths about brain function, and offers practical advice on improving cognitive function. It's called Keep Sharp, Build a Better Brain at Any Age. Dr. Gupta has been a practicing neurosurgeon for about 20 years and is an associate professor of medicine at Emory University School of Medicine. He's performed brain surgery in war zones and disaster zones, including Iraq and Afghanistan. Dr. Sanjay Gupta, welcome to Fresh Air. This is a difficult time with the virus. You know, many people are working at home while schooling their children and doing more housework than ever before because everybody's home. And the people who are working have to work in places where they don't necessarily feel safe. How do you think our brains are being affected by all of the stress of the virus?
It's been really challenging. You know, I think that there is a thing about stress and the brain that has long been documented. And the headline is that stress is not necessarily the enemy. In fact, we need a certain amount of stress. It's what gets us out of bed in the morning, makes us perform well on tests, hopefully, all that sort of stuff. But it is that second adjective you used, unrelenting, that is really problematic here. We need these breaks from stress. You need that constant sort of ebb and flow, and that's what's missing. Again, you don't want it to all be good all the time, but you need to have that sort of up and down to some extent. With things sort of the way that they are, we're sort of in this whiplash sort of time frame with regard to the brain. On one hand, things are getting worse. We see that the numbers continue to get worse over the last few months, and you know, going into the spring, it's likely to continue that trajectory. On the other hand, we also hear that there is a vaccine that is rolling out. It is happening. And that is going to be a significant impact in terms of bringing this pandemic to an end. So it's challenging for the brain right now, but it's important to constantly find times when you can either dramatically reduce your stress, either by thinking about the future with the vaccine and things like that, or other things in your life. But I will say, and this really came out in the book, the idea of eliminating stress, I'm just going to eliminate my stress, it is not obtainable, nor is it necessarily a good idea for the brain.
One of the things people are learning to do now is to live with new routines because you're working at home or teaching your children or getting to work in a different way, having to wear a mask. There's so many new routines that most of us have had to learn. Is that stressful on the brain, having to like reorganize your life and not follow all the predictable patterns that you were used to?
I would argue that it's actually very good for your brain to find new patterns, new routines, and to, you know, mix it up a little bit, shock the brain, shock the body a little bit, not in a bad way, but just in terms of trying different things. Here's the thinking is that when you start to do procedural things over and over again, you can get very good at them. And that's important in a lot of jobs, including, you know, in the operating room where I spend a lot of time. But I think for our brain, we want to constantly be using new paths and trails and roads within our brain. And that can be as simple as just doing something a little differently, eating with your left hand instead of your right hand, if you're right-handed. You know, if you put a tie on in the morning like I do, sometimes closing your eyes and doing it in the dark. The reason being you're just, the more you can recruit different parts of your brain to do even simple activities, the better it is for your brain now and the better it is for your long-term brain health.
A lot of people are multitasking, trying to do two things at once. Hmm. Are we fooling ourselves when we're multitasking?
I was surprised by this one. Even though I've been studying the brain for a long time, there was a lot that I learned, and the issues around multitasking were one of them. You know, the idea that you move from one task to another sounds great and very efficient. The issue was that they found you actually divert a fair amount of attention each time you do that. You may not notice it yourself, But when you start to objectively measure this with different types of brain scans, scans that are measuring the function of the brain or particular parts of the brain at any given millisecond, you find that you actually expend quite a bit of energy just to switch from one task to another. So you think you're doing both simultaneously, but you're probably doing neither as well as you could be, and you're probably going to take more time than if you just did them linearly in some way.
You write that two things that have stirred a revolution in neuroscience and our thinking about the brain are, one, the fact that brain cells can regenerate through our lifetimes, and two, that we can change the brain's circuitry through neuroplasticity. What does it mean that brain cells can regenerate through our lifetimes?
We long believed that brain cells, neurons, would only sort of continue to develop or go through this neurogenesis, you know, new brain cell development process at two different times, really when you were very young and still developing your brain as a baby, or if you've had some sort of injury. And at that point, the brain may start to either recruit new brain cells or even grow new brain cells. What we've come to understand over the last decade is that even outside of those two conditions, just in normal life, without an injury or as an adult, you can still grow new brain cells. That was a really pretty significant thing. Before that, the brain was thought to be largely immutable, sort of fixed, you know, and really measured only by its inputs and its outputs, you know, sort of a black box of sorts. We've obviously been able to explore the brain differently, and we've been able to see this neurogenesis, evidence of this neurogenesis throughout our entire lives, which was really a remarkable finding, and I think very inspiring as well.
So is the act of learning something new what is generating new brain cells?
I think the act of learning new things, the act of experiencing something new, or even doing something that's typical for you but in a different way, can all generate these new brain cells and these new pathways, these new functional pathways throughout the brain. I think that's the most critical thing, is that you can use the same roads and go to the same buildings you always go to, and pretty soon you'll be really good at that. That's the practice makes perfect part of things. But as you have these new experiences, these new learnings, these new activities, whatever they may be, something that gets you out of your comfort zone, maybe is how I described it, you will start to build new things within your brain.
A lot of people assume you kind of lose the ability to learn new things at a certain age or to create new habits or new patterns of behavior. Is that true?
I really don't think that that's true. I mean, it would be fair to say that, you know, the brain, like any other organ, if you were to look at it, it ages. That shouldn't surprise anybody. It ages. It's going to change. The brain itself, just the physical matter of the brain, is going to change as you get older. But in terms of what it can do, processing speed, the ability to learn new things, all of that, that is not limited. Perhaps some of your senses start to diminish, your eyesight, you may need reading glasses, your hearing, things like that. But your ability to actually be able to process, to understand, to apply, that really, not only does it not change, it can actually get sharper, can get better as you get older if you continue to use it. It is sort of the use it or lose it phenomenon when it comes to the brain, if you think of the brain like a muscle, which I think is a fair metaphor.
Do you think a healthy brain is measured by how well you can memorize things? How do you measure what a healthy brain is?
I think a healthy brain is really measured by beyond the basic critical functions of being able to get you through your day, the activities of daily living, all those things. It's really about your happiness and how much joy you have. I know, which sounds euphemistic, but if your brain is designed to obviously take care of the critical functions, breathing, respiration, heart rate, blood pressure, things like that, your brainstem functions, beyond that, it's the things that get you through the day and create the most positive living experience you can have. That's really what the brain should be doing if the brain is working well and we're treating the brain right.
So your brain shouldn't be saying you didn't do a good enough job, but nobody likes you. that's not a healthy brain.
That's a toxic brain.
That's a toxic brain, right.
That's a toxic brain. And we all live with that because we live in a society in which that is what we're exposed to often. But the brain left to its own devices has one purpose, and it's to just serve the individual. And so how does any organ serve you? You wouldn't ask about the heart that way. A happy heart is a healthy heart. A happy brain is a healthy brain. But they all exist to serve the individual. That's it, to serve no one else.
At a time when many journalists are facing increasing threats around the world, my guest Maria Ressa has stood up to one of the world's most dangerous leaders. Ressa is a co-founder and executive editor of Rappler, an online media organization based in Manila. She's been covering the rise of the populist authoritarian president Rodrigo Duterte since he was a mayor in the Philippines. When he became president in 2016, Ressa and her reporters covered Duterte's bloody war on drugs, his expanding grip on all parts of the government, and his crackdown on the press. Ressa and Rappler have faced 13 government investigations. She now faces 9 criminal charges. In June, Ressa and another reporter were convicted of cyber libel, defaming someone online. It's a Filipino law that's being applied retroactively because the law didn't even exist when the alleged crime was committed. They are appealing and are still fighting other charges. They also face constant threats of assassination and jail from Duterte, his supporters, and the army of internet trolls they unleash. Ressa sees this abuse of power and the weaponized use of the internet as a danger to democracies everywhere. Maria Ressa was born in the Philippines and grew up in the U.S. She worked for CNN for 2 decades. She ran CNN's bureau in Manila and then the Jakarta bureau and served as CNN's lead investigative reporter focusing on terrorism in the region. Ressa decided to make Manila her home and created Rappler. Her fearless work has garnered attention worldwide. Now there's a documentary about her work called 1,000 Cuts, directed by Ramona Diaz. It's available online at pbs.org and on YouTube. Maria Ressa, welcome to Fresh Air, and I so admire your courage and the journalism that you have been doing. So thank you for coming on our show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to quote some of the things that President Duterte has said. And this first one got a lot of applause. He said, "If you don't kill me now, 4 months from now, I'll roast you like a pig." He said, "Just because you're a journalist, you think you're exempted from assassination?" In a speech, he said, "When I became president, I said, do not do drugs because I will kill you. I have 3 more years. I'm really going to finish you off. You'll see." At his inaugural address, he said, "If you're into drugs, someday you'll make a mistake and I will kill you." It's just horrifying to hear a president speak about killing his citizens like that. Do you take him at his word, especially with journalists, saying that just because you're a journalist, you're not exempt from assassination?
I think that's the one thing he's always delivered, his threats. You know, the funny thing is in 2015, which was when we were trying to figure out, was he really going to run or not? I sat down with him, and that was the first time I'd interviewed him since 1989. So I interviewed him a long, long time ago, and then in 2015. And in that interview, he admitted that he killed 3 people on camera, you know? And at that point, maybe the way American journalists covered Trump, it was like, I didn't quite know what to think or how to react. But since then, every quote that you've said, it creates a new beginning of how the president uses his power, right? He doesn't lie about it. He threatens, and you know, he creates a list of people he says are drug addicts. And in that, he gave me this list. This is now in 2016, December 2016, he's already president. We're sitting at the palace and he gives me a thick list, like almost a foot long. And he says, "These are all the drug addicts." And I was like, "Is this proven?" He said, "Well, no, not yet." But then slowly over the next few years, those people on that drug list, they wound up dead. I think the difference between the United States and the Philippines, between Trump and Duterte, is you have institutions. And while Americans say that your institutions aren't strong enough, they were strong enough to hold a strong president. We have a president who's boasted of killing people and continues to encourage the police and the military to kill people. We don't know what to do with that.
In one of your interviews with President Duterte, you said to him, "You break the law. You threaten to break the law. You've said you killed, and yet you have the task of keeping the rule of law. Is it important that people be afraid of you?" And he answered, "Yes, for the rule of law, there must be fear." So that's a very brave question to have asked him, especially since his government has been investigating and threatening you. What is it like for you to confront him with questions like that?
You know, that was December of 2016. And I was one of four reporters that he gave an interview to at the palace. With President Duterte at that point, I was really curious because he believes that he understands the Filipino psyche. And really, his understanding of the psyche is all about bullying. He believes that Filipinos do not follow the law and that they must be threatened into doing that. I had asked him earlier, you know, how are you going to make this country? We're 110 million people, and it's been a tough democracy that's kind of, you know, had weak institutions, weak law enforcement, endemic corruption. How are you going to handle this? And he says, no, I'll be different because I know how the Filipinos think. And then he said how he would use institutions like the tax agency to run after and make Filipinos follow. Well, little did I know then that the tax agency would come after me because I'm doing my job, right? I face 5 tax evasion cases that the government has filed. And all because we've been reclassified from a news organization to a stock brokerage. Like, let me think of the exact. Yeah. See, this is what, when I actually go into it, I just go, oh my God. We were reclassified as a dealer in securities. That's the exact quote. So Rappler as an entity is not a news organization. We are a, quote, dealer in securities. And because we are, we then should have paid all the taxes that a stock brokerage agency would, right? That makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Well, that makes as much sense as being tried retroactively for a law that didn't exist when the so-called crime was committed, which is what happened to you with the libel case. So it is really remarkable what you're facing now. In the U.S., a lot of people who do not support Trump have been asking, what is the appeal of somebody who has made so many baseless claims, who has threatened journalists, and who often seems to have no interest in actually governing? And I'm wondering if you have figured out, what is the appeal of Duterte? Because he has a lot of followers.
Yes, he does. I think there are two things. And one of our reporters actually says this in the film. Populism brings an illusion of power to people who may feel powerless. And our reporter in the film said he promises revenge. So it's, again, that split of the haves versus the have-nots. There's a big gap between the rich and the poor in the Philippines. And President Duterte has styled himself as coming from the poor, even though that's not actually true, right? His supporters will say he's like someone you can have a beer with. But he is in his 70s, so he is sexist at best. He's a misogynist at worst. And he says things that you would never expect to come from a leader's mouth.
I want to hear more about how you think Duterte's attacks on journalists and attacks on other people who oppose him have changed your approach to journalism as the executive editor of The Rappler.
That's a great question. I'll say it from experience, right? So the first target of attack, the woman who went to jail early on in February 2017, was Senator Leila de Lima, former Justice Secretary, former head of the Commission on Human Rights. She investigated Duterte when he was still mayor for extrajudicial killings. When the government was throwing all the charges against her, that she was a drug dealer, that was a charge thrown against her, we were reporting it as if it was still the old world. And I guess there was a part of me that was thinking that, would the government really say all these things if they didn't have the evidence? So it's your question about, now it's happening to me, right? Yes. The response is, yes, the government will do it, even if they have no evidence. In fact, the president, just in December, President Duterte, named lawmakers who he said were corrupt. And then the next sentence is, but I have no evidence. He still named them. And they were then forced to defend themselves the next day, right? So how does it change the way we report? So the first is, you become very skeptical of government and its processes. Like in December, when the president named these lawmakers, we didn't print those names. Because when he said there is no evidence, why would you print them? But in the old days, you would print them because he's the president, right? So I guess the norms have changed in that sense. And then the second one is, in my case, I think the big shift for me is I've realized that when you're in a battle for facts, journalism is activism. And that's a big shift because I grew up a traditional journalist. I believe I helped write the standards and ethics of three different news groups, right? So getting to that point where it was actually when I was arrested. And after they detained me and held me overnight, they made a point to arrest me when courts closed. And it was February 13th because the next day was Valentine's Day, right? It's February 13th, 2018. And I couldn't post bail. It was too late to post bail. So I had to stay the night in jail. And the next day when I came out, I was so angry because the government's power was used to make me feel its power, to intimidate me. That was the goal. And that's when I realized I don't have to ask anyone else whether you've done anything wrong. I don't have to look for it. I know this. So that's when I began to speak, and I actually realized in this day and age, you have to call it. You have to say a lie is a lie. You have to challenge in ways that we traditional journalists are uncomfortable with.
Part of your arrest is filmed for the documentary, and you speak to the press after you're arrested. And you are so cool and so calm, and your thoughts are so kind of organized when you make those comments. And I was watching it thinking, how does she do that? How does she remain calm at a time like this and just, you know, say what she needs to say?
I was so angry. You know, when I watched that, when I watched the film, it was like getting punched in the gut. Because when you live through it, it's like, it happens in slow motion and you take it and you move on. You know, I live my life step by step. I know which direction I need to go in. That particular one, I was detained overnight. There's several of these now. I don't know which one it was. But in each one, I know that I need to tamp down the anger. It's kind of like doing a live shot. Right. This is a good thing that I guess I took from 20 years with CNN and doing live shots. All hell can be breaking loose around you, and you have to take what you know, push your emotion down, and have clarity of thought. And like a live shot, I pegged to what are the three main things that I want to say, and that's how I speak. The worse it is, the calmer I get.
That is so interesting that your CNN experience doing live reporting helped you. It makes a lot of sense. On a related note, do you think that the cameras from the documentary about you, the other cameras from the press, do you think that they protect you in any way? Or do they make things worse because it calls more attention to you?
No, they protect. You know, at the beginning, if you come under attack, you think that, you know, just be quiet. You, at least that's the impact in the Philippines of President Duterte. You try to just do your jobs, but that's not the way it works. And to me, it all came to a head in December 2018 when Time made me one of the covers for the Person of the Year. And I didn't know that that was going to happen. So the first time I saw it was a tweet. And when it came out, I was like, oh my gosh. The first thing I did was I thought it was false. So I sent it to our social media team to verify. But when I got the call, I thought, oh my gosh, now I'm really going to be targeted. I already was targeted. And what I didn't realize and what I embraced later on is that that was a shield. And that's the same thing with the documentary film. Washington Post, I think their new banner says it, right? Democracy dies in darkness. Staying quiet when the Constitution is being violated, when your rights are being violated, that doesn't help anyone. And I guess that's the lesson I've learned, that whatever it is, call it, shine the light. Because if you don't, it's going to happen over and over again.
You face 9 criminal charges now. You were found guilty of cyber libel. You faced the possibility of 6 years in prison. How likely are you to actually be in prison for 6 years?
I don't know. And I guess that's part of what's difficult about the last few years. That's only one of the 9 criminal cases that have been filed against me. All of them, of course, politically motivated. I've done nothing wrong but be a journalist. Having said that, all the charges combined could send me to jail for 100 years. I mean, the rest of my life. And how likely is it? You know, let me put it this way. It's like how I live my life today, how I fight the battle today will make it more or less likely that I go to jail, right? And that's why in a strange way, I think that the battle is the journey. The journey is the battle, if that makes sense. I feel like what I do today will make a difference, will determine what my future is going to be like. And that, I guess that's a good thing. it's late at night my time, right? But
Yes, it's 11 o'clock your time at night. Yeah.
I think, I don't know what the future will look like, but I do know that every day that we hold the line, every day that we hold power to account, makes it more certain that we will remain a democracy, and that I stay out of jail.
Well, listen, I wish you safety. I hope you stay out of prison, and I hope you stay healthy. Thank you for the work that you do. You're a very courageous woman.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and for listening to me.
Maria Ressa is the executive editor and CEO of Rappler, an online media organization based in Manila. A PBS Frontline documentary about her called 1,000 Cuts, directed by Ramona Diaz, is available online at pbs.org and on YouTube.